Welcome, Dr. Sand, to Monday Mile.
I'm a big fan of this. Since I met you, I guess the last time I saw you, you were giving me a snowboarding lesson on a fake plastic hill. And now I watch you every day on my Instagram.
Yes, love that. So we've literally just scooped you up from work. You've just finished Morning Live. How was it?
It was all right. The problem is that I just have to get up. So it's not that early in the morning. It's just that I only get up at sort of 5:45 2 days a week. And so I then spend the rest of the day wondering when I'm gonna crash. Like, when am I just gonna hit the bottom?
And right now, we are quite literally joining you on your commute to the next destination.
I'm off to do Operation Ouch.
Oh, I love that.
So I've actually sent my wardrobe ahead, which feels quite grand, and I felt like a massive diva, like texting everyone going, I'm gonna send my wardrobe separately and then I'm gonna walk. Like, what are you doing? But anyway.
Do you normally walk?
I would normally cycle, actually. I love cycling, and it is the nicest way of getting around London.
It is for sure.
But if there's clothes, the problem is that with the clothes, like I never look ironed anyway. Like, I never look pressed.
That's not your vibe.
I ironed this morning and I look like I slept in it.
To be fair, I'm not very good with an iron myself. I tried.
But you always look put together.
Oh, I don't know about that, but thank you. Thank you.
I think you do.
So we actually met, as you said, through CBBC Operation Ouch, where I had the unique opportunity to teach you how to snowboard. How did you find it?
What I thought was really interesting, actually, because I do loads of different sort of things for Operation Ouch, where you just get like a tiny taste of a thing.
Yeah.
So snowboarding with you, where you have this incredible opportunity to have someone who's an absolute world expert teach you a thing in like 10 minutes, and most of it's filming and we have to like get setting up and doing shots and stuff. And then I'm trying to just get something valuable out of the experience that will actually be, you know, I know that you haven't turned me into a snowboarder, but like, what can I learn from you? And the thing I most remember is that you turned up, and it's, you know, I think people who don't have children who are watching the show can easily not take children's television very seriously, and you turned up and you were absolutely on it. And you did the lovely thing of going, all right, let's do the absolute best we can for this. Obviously your snowboarding teaching was really good, but the main thing was like, you just went, okay, but let's take this really seriously and do it as well as we possibly can. And I think in telly a lot of the time people attempted to slightly cuff it off, and you were really, really good on the show in a way that I think any kid watching it would go, this is excellent. I can learn something about myself from it. It was really good.
That is way too kind. I was more expecting to delve into my ability to teach you to snowboard, and I definitely threw you in at the deep end. Do you remember doing the drop in?
I absolutely
impaled yourself on your back.
I have no natural ability to do anything like that at all.
I was going to say no fear, or would you say ignorance is bliss?
I think if you point a camera at someone, that like removes the fear of not getting your filming done is much bigger
Kodak
than
courage.
The fear of like, okay, if I, yeah, something like that. What do you call it?
Kodak courage. So,
oh, that's amazing. Like, it's actually got to work.
Yeah, totally. You know, if you're like, I'm going to do this, but I actually wouldn't do this unless there's a camera rolling, because this could go really wrong.
Yeah, so at least I'll have footage of it. Maybe it's something like
that. We need to dig into the archives to find that bail, because it's definitely there somewhere.
It hasn't gone out yet. I also think if you commit to something filming, then you at least get the authentic experience of me having a go at something, which is sort of what anyone would have found, I think.
So you've spent a large portion of your career in sub-Saharan Africa. Tell us a little bit about that portion of your life.
So when I became a doctor with the idea that obviously I wanted to help people and kind of change the world and make the world a better place, but I also wanted to have adventures and see things I hadn't seen before. I had a very lovely, comfortable childhood growing up in London with my parents. I went to a private day school. And
Wimbledon?
I went to King's in Wimbledon. And nice. I just had this sense that there was just so many lives I knew nothing about. And so part of it, when you say like, you know, I worked with refugees and displaced people in war zones in Africa, you start to sound like a really sort of like a really nice person. And I want to be a nice person, but also there was a huge selfish motivation to doing it.
And what was that?
To go and find out what the rest of the world looked like and how, like, war is something you see all the time on the TV or in the newspapers. It was always in the headlines. I went to, the first place I worked was Sudan in Darfur, where there was a genocide going on and it had all been in the headlines and all the celebrities were out there raising awareness. And I just didn't have any idea. I felt like I always opened a newspaper and went, I don't know where this country is.
I think it's very hard to relate. Like you said, growing up in London, I grew up just outside of London. It's hard to relate and feel the emotions and the connection when it is so far removed. And we are so privileged in that it is so far removed from everyday life for us. But yeah, I guess to see it like that raw in the flesh really puts a different perspective on it.
It definitely did. And I think that there's like sort of, sounds awful to say I was sort of satisfying my curiosity, but I think I really did want to understand what was going on and why one bit of the world could look so different to where I'd grown up. So basically, I trained in tropical medicine after I finished medical school.
And for anyone that doesn't know, what is tropical medicine? Give us a broader insight.
Well, so tropical medicine, so I went to the Liverpool, there are two schools of tropical medicine in the UK. There's Liverpool and London. Okay, let me try and answer this as best I can. Tropical medicine is now a slightly unfashionable term because it comes out of empire. There are connections to the slave trade, to colonialization. All of that part of our history is why we have schools of tropical medicine in the UK. And in fact, tropical medicine, although we think of it as things like malaria, HIV, tuberculosis, sort of diseases of infectious diseases largely of people in the tropics, because those infections are different because they can be spread by insects that we just don't have in this country. In fact, they're diseases of poverty and inequality and oppression. And so really tropical medicine is truthfully looking at the medicine of poor and vulnerable people, and really people whose poverty and vulnerability is very closely linked to like our history, my history, you know, our success in this country is quite closely connected. So tropical medicine's this quite sort of, I don't know, like quite a fraught history and quite a complicated term. But basically anyone studying it, most people studying it just want to try and make the world a better place in some way. Does that make sense?
It totally makes sense. That sounds like a really like positive spin on that particular, would you call it a discipline? Because in sport we call them disciplines.
So medicine chops up in a strange way. But I would say it's a discipline, in as much as there's sort of a whole collection of practice and experts and professors and textbooks and specialist institutes and universities, and like we're just around the corner from the London School of Tropical Medicine here. So it is a discipline, but it's a very messy one, where in fact it's more useful to know history, economics, anthropology, and to speak a bit of the local language, or it's as useful as knowing how to treat malaria. So I didn't mean to barge you into that chair.
That's all right, I'll let you off. Tell us a little bit about your work right now at UCL.
This morning you've had so many people that some of whom I know, but I really admire on this podcast. And I was thinking, I don't quite fit the mold of, I haven't won an Olympic medal.
You don't need to win an Olympic medal to be on this podcast.
Earn your place on Monday Mile.
No, it's not about that.
I think about my sort of work overseas in wars and emergencies quite a lot, and think, how is it relevant to life at home? Because actually, if you're trying to improve the lives of people overseas, there's as I said, I had a kind of selfish motivation, and really, you know, if you start at home, you realize how much more difficult it is. Like in the UK, I can vote, I can talk to the government, I can I can do all kinds of things to change the world.
So through your work at UCL and the amount of time you've spent in sub-Saharan Africa, we spoke briefly about the subject of power. What does power mean to you?
So we use the term power all the time. I think everyone in the UK could use it in a sentence and it would make sense. But actually, when you talk about having power and getting power and not being powerful enough, those things are really, really hard to pin down. So if you say, I won't do it to you, but my undergraduates, what I would say when I was teaching them is, define power. Like, what does it mean to have power?
Do you want to do it to me, or am I going to end up?
All right. What does it mean if I say you've got power? What does that mean?
So, a part of me thinks like a strong, confident female, and I'm not a feminist. For me, that is what I envisage power to be.
Okay. And so, if you had to say, of the two of us, who's the most powerful person? Who would you pick?
Obviously me.
That, and why would you say that?
No. I don't know if I would be able to, like, credibly say who is more powerful.
I think that's the right answer.
I don't think there is, like, more power or less power. I think it's maybe about the deeper rooted confidence in where you stand within society.
Okay, that's really, that to me is really like a beautiful answer.
So oh, yes.
It's really nice, I've not failed the test. But it's really, I always feel, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I always feel like it is more interesting if you try and answer. So
okay.
Whenever I said to my undergrads, who's the most powerful person in the room, they'd all say me because I'm the professor. They employ me and they pay my salary and their ratings directly determine whether I keep my job. And if they want to get me fired as a group, they get me fired in a heartbeat, whereas I can't get them all kicked out of university. So actually, as you parse it out, you sort of go, well, who is the most powerful person in the room? Then you might have someone in the class who's given a lot of money to the university, or who's just incredibly rich, or whose dad is a minister, or whose mum is in charge of the department. All this mess, right?
Oh, that almost like frustrates me though, because I don't believe that. Like the noise, the white noise around who's this, who's got that, who's qualified in this or that. It's just, for me, that's just blah.
So I think you're exactly right in that in the end, you cannot tell who's the most powerful person in any situation until you start to test it. So
okay.
Like on this walk,
yep.
We're both just here going along. I want to be on the podcast. You want me on the podcast. We're just happy to be making it. I want to go for a walk. I want to get eventually somewhere in that direction. Like no power is being wielded. You're not making me do anything I don't want to do. And I'm not making you do anything you don't want to do, which is that's the first definition of power, as you'd say.
Yep.
Do you have the ability to make someone do a thing they don't want to do? And it's just not happening most of the time. Like in most of life, you've signed up, you've agreed to come to the office, they give you money, you do the work, whatever the thing might be.
Yeah.
But the lovely thing about it means that the lovely thing about power is that then in any situation it's always negotiated, right? That if I want to get you to do something that you want to do, it's not just how much power I've got over you in terms of, I don't know, whether I can pay you or whether you're trying to change the government's rules on food labeling or whether I want a different COVID policy. It will all be a tussle. It'll all be a kind of wrestling match where you'll eventually figure out who is able to control the situation, who can make the other person do the thing they don't want to do. Are you going to have to accept the loss, or can you go out and find a way around it? Can you find some way to negotiate your way through? So the thing, I feel like even I, as someone in many ways a privileged position, feel quite powerless in loads of situations.
Give us an example of situations where you feel powerless.
I mean, there would be lots of small things in the day, but if I think of big things, I just think I would like the world to be better in lots of ways. Like, there are lots of hungry children in the UK. There are huge, you know, the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer. These sort of massive social issues, I would like them to be different, and I can't bend the world to my will. I can't make it happen. Open the paper and go, oh, this is all, you know, all the stuff I see is terrible, but I want to make it better, but I'm just me. I'm just this small, and I have a voice, a platform, people listen to me sometimes, occasionally, like I get to be a guest on the podcast.
Yeah.
And I still can't change the
world. So even in situations, well, in world situations, you, me, we are powerless in the scheme of the bigger movement, which is decided by someone else.
You often feel like you can't do anything, and actually you always can. No matter how disempowered you are, no matter how little power you feel you wield, no matter how much you feel excluded, there is some possibility to get hold of other people, to organize, to get things around you, to make your way through it. That there is no situation in which you're so constrained you cannot start to influence your world and change it a bit.
Yes.
And that's like how every great change ever happened. And I, my emotional experiences, I just feel like, oh, this is all hopeless. And then what I love about the humanitarian work I was doing was it was just such a lesson in going, people with nothing, whose village had been blown to bits, not only could they help themselves and do things for themselves, but they could organize, they could rebuild a world, they could still resist an abusive government in ways that, if they can do it, then
then I feel
like anyone should be out trying to change things.
I think it's about like making small incremental changes each day rather than looking at the bigger picture and almost being deflated by it.
Yeah, so that lovely idea of like, just biting off small things. Like you can only do so much in a day, but you can do something. I mean, you must have found this when you're training, that if you go, you know, that's the mountain I've got to get down, and these are all the things I'm going to have to do.
Or even like relating it back to, like accessible fitness, like running, for example. Mm. If I said to you, Dr. Zand, you've got to run a marathon tomorrow, what would be the chances? Like, probably pretty slim, right? I don't think. But if I said to you, you've got to run 2 miles tomorrow for the following Monday, 4.5 the Monday after that, after 10 weeks, you'd be running the marathon.
It's like a really nice example of just, and if that's the thing, if you can start with your body, and go, okay, I can make a difference to myself today. I can do something. And if you do, like, if I do that, what was the place you want to start? Like a mile, 2 miles?
Yep.
If I run for 2 miles, you could literally blood test before, blood test afterwards. You could measure changes in my fitness that would be like proper improvements, even over a single bit of exercise.
And for the people that are interested, what would those changes in your blood be? Let's get a little bit nitty-gritty.
Okay,
let's get the doctor side of things.
So when there was a sort of moment a few years ago when high intensity training became like this, along with like the 4-hour work week, like everything could be made more efficient, right? You could just do everything quickly. And so there was a lot of research done on very high intensity short bursts of exercise. And they were doing it in people who really didn't want to do any exercise at all. So there's a study in Canada looking at people who are overweight or obese with type 2 diabetes, who put them on the exercise bike, get them to work really hard for sort of a couple of minutes, and then see if you could find an improvement. And so one of the measurements that's really lovely is insulin sensitivity. So does your body respond better to the hormone insulin, which lowers your blood sugar? So high blood sugar, not good if you've got diabetes, not good even if you're pre-diabetic.
Yeah.
So someone like me who's got a bit of a tummy, you know, I might be a bit less sensitive to insulin now, even if it's still working effectively. My blood sugars are mostly normal. If you do even a small amount of exercise, you can measure that your body is responding to its own hormones more effectively. I think that's amazing.
Yeah, that is.
And I always think, like, because I never want, like, especially if I haven't exercised for a while, like last year I was really ill, I fully quit doing any exercise at all. And then you think, oh, to get back to anything is going to take months.
Yeah.
And actually you can get a benefit in 2 minutes. That's bananas, isn't it?
That's really motivating,
quite good,
isn't it? Should do a little hit session after this.
Oh, we could do a bit, do a bit of hits around Russell Square.
Have you got
a quick regime? Have you got a 2-minute regime?
I reckon we can throw something in at the end.
Do you know that was the thing that I was going to like beg my trainer not to do, because I just find that stuff really, like the circuit stuff, that so painful.
It is brutal, isn't it? So talking about bodies, we can't not delve into your latest podcast project, Thorough Examination. Give us a little nugget of what's going on there.
Okay, so this would be like, I would say this is the first thing I've done where my brother and I have properly just gone, we're going to do this, we're going to create this thing. It's purely our mad little project, but we are going to try and change the world with it. And I don't think I've ever done anything which has been so much like our idea, and it's so personal. So the background is, I've got a twin brother called Chris.
Yep.
He spent 4 years working on a film for BBC One about child obesity. And child obesity is really like fiddly, complicated subject, because children cannot take responsibility. You can't go, it's your fault that you're overweight, the way that people are often tempted to with grown-ups. So it's a very useful way of looking at obesity, going, why are children getting bigger? Why are we having a massive, massive problem with overweight in kids? So the place that Chris landed after doing tons of research was ultra-processed food, what we're feeding our children. The average teenager in the UK now gets 80% of their calories from ultra-processed food.
That is absolutely horrendously terrifying.
And it's bad. Like, if you're an athlete, you're used to feeding yourself properly, but this is like the stuff that exists all around us. So ultra-processed food is the definition that's easy to use would be like, it's in a plastic packet, it's made with some sort of industrial process that you probably wouldn't have in your kitchen, and it has ingredients that are not found typically in like a normal home kitchen. Right. So it's not hard to identify this stuff, but we're all eating flavorings, fillers, emulsifiers.
Crisps, sweets,
it's all that stuff.
Pizza.
Nuggets.
Nuggets.
Loads of takeaway food is filled with stuff that you wouldn't normally cook with, like thickeners and these sorts of things.
It's quite scary, isn't it?
It's very scary, and there's really good data that this stuff makes you fat. And it's not fat, sugar, salt, protein. It's not that combination. It's not just this food is high in sodium and high in fat and sugar. So if you take groups of people and you feed them diets that are the same for salt, sugar, fat and protein,
yep.
But one food is ultra-processed and the other part of food isn't, what you find is they eat 500 calories a day more if it's ultra-processed food. Not because it's more delicious, just because it's got a compulsive quality to it and it's soft so you can eat it quickly. A chicken nugget you can eat very quickly.
Is it because there's an element of addiction that's created through the processed food? Because you know, like, if you have some nuggets, you're like, oh, I'll have some more, or...
Even if you're not really enjoying them, you're like, it's not the best thing ever, but I will still finish the pile of nuggets.
Yeah.
So this is what the podcast is about, is my brother went, you are now overweight, unhealthy. Since I got COVID, I have a heart condition. And he just went, you're 42, we need to get you fixed. Haranguing your family about their diet doesn't work. Saying that food is addictive, it sort of doesn't make sense because you have to eat.
Yeah.
So a lot of addiction stuff, you'd say, well, you know, you need to quit the thing, like alcohol or cigarettes or drugs. But with food, you can't quit food. But you can quit ultra-processed food quite easily, in fact. Like, depending on who you are, I can.
So you've started the journey.
So, in fact, we did the opposite. Chris just went, look, eat it all and think about it when you eat it.
Oh, no.
And so my whole diet changed. So I was eating pure ultra-processed food. But the difference is that I was doing it where, as I did it, I was interviewing all these scientists, speaking to all these experts that Chris put me in touch with, who were talking me through the data on what it was doing to my body.
Oh, that is
and
brutal.
You eat a packet of, you know, if you think of like a tube of potato, you know, those sort of potato discs, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
If you think of those, he did a lovely experiment on me where he if you put, you know, those crisps, I don't want to name the brand, but
yeah,
like there's lots of, but
they're in a tube.
I believe it's called something like a parabolic, I think it's a parabolic disc. Anyway, they're in the tube. The ones in the tube.
The famous ones in the tube.
But there are no-name brands as well. They're all equally bad for you. The normal experience is you take it out and you put the whole thing on your tongue, right?
And you get
this boom, this crunch in your head,
yeah,
and this huge sensory experience and all the flavor at once. So if you take those and just crumble them into flakes, they're instantly a lot less delicious.
Yep.
If you turn them into a powder, they become quite disgusting.
Ooh, no.
If you mix the powder with water, so you've just got a gunch, you're having the same food, the same flavor, but you've removed all the science to make it addictive.
All the bells and whistles.
It's gross. It's absolutely gross.
So did you eat that particular crisp smashed up with water?
And it's truly horrible.
Has it traumatized your experience with those crisps?
You don't want them anymore. And that was Chris's point, is if you sit down and eat it carefully and thoughtfully, the way that you'd like have, you
a
know,
nice
if you went to like a nice
restaurant
and you'd be like savouring it and enjoying, or like a glass of wine or a nicely made beer or something like that, you'd be like, oh, the flavours and all the stuff. If you do that with ultra processed food, you can taste the chemicals, you can taste the process, you can taste the weirdness. And so the plan was to get me to quit it on my own by making, like, force feeding me this food while we spoke to different people about my relationship with food and about the science and the modern obesity epidemic.
Wow.
And it's quite emotional.
It's like the reverse psychology of actually forcing you to eat it. Has it quite literally had the adverse effect?
100%.
So say if I was like, right, or you said to me, Amy, you're going to eat 5 pizzas, 4 burgers, 5 rounds of chicken nuggets, would that be enough to put me off?
We did it for a few weeks.
To be fair, I don't like burgers,
I think the things... I mean, I would hope that if that was your weakness, I mean, I suspect it's just not your weakness.
No.
Like, you're an athlete.
So.
I would guess that you feed yourself quite well.
I do like my yoghurt, though. Oh, I have a good
but
old...
yoghurt's fine. So yoghurt's not ultra... unless you're having, like, yoghurt,
too
tons
much
of flavouring and
yeah,
stuff like that. But so basically, really, if you think 50 years ago, almost no one was obese in
yeah,
the general population. You could find people who are obese, but it was very uncommon. Compared to now, majority of people in the UK yep. are overweight or obese, like most people, including me. That's unbelievable.
That's mad that you would be considered obese.
And though, I'm not, like, I'm 6 foot, I can sort of pack it all over myself.
You don't look
But
obese.
Actually, it's all in here. It's all yep. packed around my organs. It's doing me tremendous harm. And so the nice thing about the podcast is this, the two of us as brothers, and Chris is trying to help his brother, but how you help your family member is like, oh, if you think about power, like how do you change your family member? How do you get your brother to do something he doesn't want to do? Yeah. That's the nightmare. And he managed, I think he did it really beautifully in a way that if you were listening to it, if you struggled with the junk food, I think you could sort of eat along with Zand and kind of get into it in the same way.
Cool.
It's not like a join in podcast. It's not really self-help, yeah. but it's definitely got a little bit of that.
Oh, wow. That sounds like a really positive project for you both to invest time into, where not only you, but anyone listening, hopefully will reap the rewards and the knowledge and understanding of what creates the food addiction.
I think it is. It's all very deliberately designed to be compulsive and to make you eat more. Like, you can't run a successful multinational food corporation without making the food compulsive or addictive in some way.
And this comes back to power, right?
So then, basically, the podcast is to try and take it to the massive food corporations and go, you're harming people, you're killing children, your products, there is good data that your products are associated with obesity, cancer, diabetes, heart disease, etc. How do you take down a massive food giant? So that's like, I don't say the podcast can do it, but you start to organize, you know, we start to sort of go, could we make a dent? So do you remember this thing a couple of weeks ago? Ronaldo sat down for a press conference in the Euros.
Yeah.
And moved the two Coke bottles out of shot and said, drink water. He said, agua. And it wasn't even clear if he was advising the viewers to drink water or whether he just wasn't going to drink the Coke. But that knocked £4 billion off the share price of Coke.
What?
Isn't that amazing?
That is insane.
So that's one foot. If you feel powerless, what? Okay, he's Ronaldo.
Yeah.
But one footballer moving a couple of bottles is £4 billion. I mean, the share price rose back up again. But still, you get an idea that they're not invulnerable. That people, informed consumers,
yeah.
who don't want to be poisoned.
In Monday Mile, mm-hmm. we like to delve into people's routine. And obviously, with what you do, it does change day to day. But with the new podcast,
yeah.
the vision of tweaking your diet,
yeah.
has your routine changed with food since starting the new project?
The main thing that I've noticed, so over lockdown, I just really ordered a lot of takeaways. I was at the shop, it was hard to get to the shops. I was very busy, takeaways are easy, and I felt exhausted and rubbish. And so that all just led to a total collapse of my eating habits and general self-care.
It's too easy to pick up the phone though, and it's, anyone listening to this can relate. It's real, it's raw, and
we've
all been there.
I think that's right, and I'm certainly not trying to say I'm unusual in that, but it was bad. And going through it with my brother, just that thing of going every day, I should try to take better care of myself and invest in myself, and also understand that there are enormous forces trying to make me not be healthy. That yep. people are extracting money from me to make me fatter and less well and live less long.
It just doesn't sit well, does it, when you analyse the process?
You feel like a mug. Like I feel like a mug when I'm buying this stuff. So yeah, the main change in the routine is I've got to be organised and get to the shops, and I've got to take time to prepare food. And it's not nothing, right? Like, I would never say to anyone, it's easy to quit ultra-processed food. It's possible, as in you can identify the stuff you shouldn't eat, and your cravings will go, and you can eat pretty much whatever you want, provided it's not ultra-processed food. But you will need to set aside time, like chopping, peeling, cooking.
Yeah.
What do you do? Do you cook your own stuff?
That's a really good question. I do a bit of everything. I can relate to the ordering online when you're busy and you wear lots of different hats, a little bit like you. I'm here, there and everywhere doing different things all the time. And it comes down to time, and I think building the consistency. And I think it's about deep down how you feel and how you want to feel. And if you can relate it back to that, for me, I know when I eat well, when I sleep, when I've not been out shouting for yeah. football, I feel the best version of myself. And when I put it into perspective, that's when I make the better choices. I want to feel good. I want to be able to move well. And I don't want to feel like crap. And processed food definitely does make you feel
it properly crap. Makes you feel rubbish. And it does you, it's really interesting how bad it is for you in multiple ways. So you've got, there's an idea of the syndemic. So like there's an obesity pandemic, but as well as that, there's that is interacting with an environmental crisis. So you chop down the rainforests to grow soybeans, to extract chemicals from the soybeans, to make ultra-processed food, which gets transported around the world to one factory, sent back to the country it was grown in a different form that's less healthy. And suddenly you've got this explosion of environmental destruction, loss of biodiversity, combined with people getting fatter and less healthy. And you've got this terrible vicious circle that you can break out of once you can sort of pinpoint it and go, oh, but if I ate that was grown locally and it would be a bit better for me and better for the planet, you can get multiple wins. But it isn't, it's not straightforward.
No. I think it's even the awareness, and having this conversation today has made me more aware of the effects of ultra-processed food, because it's not something that's talked about regularly that you analyse. But yeah. When I go to pick up my phone to order something now, I'm going to be like, oh,
what can you get that's like a proper food that you could cook in your... Even if you haven't got time and you haven't been to the shops and you're going to have to order something.
Food prep is the one, isn't it?
Food prep. But I always... it's interesting. The thing I think that would be amazing is if all the labelling system we have at the moment, so confusing, all that nutritional information, no one knows what it is. There are two types of calorie on every packet. All the stuff about the vitamins and the RDAs and the sodium and the fat and the salt and sugar, you could replace it all with a label that said, is it ultra-processed food? And I think the central thing is to go, you
choice.
Cannot make healthy ultra-processed food. It cannot be done. That right. You can alter the fat and the salt and the sugar, but the essential thing is that food is, it's an edible substance designed to make a profit for a company. Oh. It's not meant to nourish you.
That
well,
is
I was
brutal.
Assuming you would you'd be on this because
yeah,
you're an
no,
athlete
like,
and your body is
I'm
a temple.
I'm aware of it, but marketing strategies, a fast-paced life, I think it's normal to let things like that slip by the wayside. And don't get me wrong, I'm not a fan of, you know, fried chips and burgers and nuggets, but I'd definitely smash a pizza every now and again. Like, who wouldn't? You're watching England play the football and you're with your mates, you're going to have a bit of pizza and...
So
a drink, right?
I would literally say, like, you can, if you choose a different pizza, you can get a pizza that doesn't have any weird ingredients.
So maybe, though, I am choosing a pizza that, I mean, I like a, you know, sourdough pizza with some veggies.
Right.
So that maybe doesn't come under that label?
Literally, I suppose the claim is quite outrageous, but it's literally like, if you eat a pizza that is made with real dough and real cheese and like a homemade tomato sauce that doesn't have any weird ingredients in, that is not ultra processed food. The kind of pizza you could make at home.
Yep.
If you roast your own chicken wings at home and cover them with butter and salt and sugar and do whatever you want to them, they will be better for you than the stuff that's made in a factory.
Good to know, good to know.
Literally.
You heard it here. So Dr. Sam, on Monday Mile, we like to ask every guest what their relationship is like with Monday, the start of the week. You don't have to conform to the, yeah, I love Mondays vibe, but what is your vibe?
I woke up at 5 o'clock this morning and I had to be out of bed at 6, so I thought I'm probably not gonna go back to sleep. And just lay in bed going, I wonder how far through the day I can get. Like basically I felt not just negative, but like, I know that my day will start to fall apart at some point. I just wonder how far I can get into it.
And on a day like today, where you've had that ridiculously early start, have you got any hacks on how you combat and manage your energy throughout the day? Or is it you're done, written off by 4?
I think sometimes when you're done, you're done.
Yeah.
And like when I had students that would sleep in my lectures, I would literally say to them, close your eyes, please give in, the monster's got you, like that's it, you're cooked, don't
love
try and
that.
Pay attention.
Love that.
My only tip, if you're trying to stay awake in a meeting where you're up crack of dawn on a Monday and you're exhausted, someone told me this, I love and I use it all the time, if you take the tip of your tongue and run it along the roof of your mouth very gently, it tickles in a very unpleasant way and that'll keep you awake in any meeting. Are you getting
so
it?
Weird.
Are you getting
that
it?
Is
it's
so
horrible,
weird.
Isn't it?
like...
And you're like, no, no, no.
Oh,
can
yeah,
you get it?
Yeah, yeah, that's...
And you don't think you can... So you can tickle the inside of your mouth to stay awake. That's my hot tip for Monday.
I love that. Love that. And lastly, Dr. Zand, do you have any takeaway points for those maybe looking or wishing to embark on a new journey with their relationship with ultra-processed food?
Okay. For someone wanting to change how they eat... how to change any aspect of their life, I think, for me, the main thing would be to go, what has stopped you up until now? Like you, I often lie in bed at night and think, tomorrow I'm going to be different, I can change. And the main thing is, you're going to, if you want to change a bit of your life, you're going to have to change your life. If you want to eat better, you're going to have to go to the shops at a different time. You might have to commute differently. You might have to get out of bed an hour earlier. You might have to change where you sit to eat your food. You might eat, there are so many things. So I think proper change is a big deal, and anyone can do it, and you'll feel amazing if you do it, and you can take charge of your life. But you will need to do more than that, like, oh, the diet starts tomorrow, which is what I always do. Instead, you've got to go, look, I better get organised on a Sunday if I want to be doing okay the next Friday.
So organisation is key.
I think so. And I say that as someone who is poorly organised and massively struggles with all this stuff. But if I can do it with my very limited skills for this stuff, I really believe that people can change themselves.
Yes. Love that. Dr. Zan, thank you so much for joining us on the Monday Mile Walk and Talk podcast. We have quite literally commuted with you all the way to your second destination.
It's really good. You've got me here.
I hope you have an epic day, rest of your day.
Oh, you're brilliant.
How are you going to stay awake?
I'm going to...
Tickle your tongue.
It's okay. I'm in a school this afternoon and you cannot fall asleep with children. We're doing sign language in schools. So it's going to be brilliant.
Fun. Monday Mile listeners, it is a wrap. Man, what an episode. A massive thank you to Dr. Zand and big ups to each and every one of you for tuning in each week. I loved that episode and I hope you did too. Some really strong takeaways for proper change. You can take charge of your life and organisation is key. I also love that discussion on power. Sometimes it really is good to just thrash it out. On that note, foot to the floor. It is Monday. Let's go. It's a new week. Have an absolutely wicked one. Can you believe we're on season 2, episode 9? That's 19 episodes of Monday Mile. Stay tuned and we'll see you next week.